Welcome to Behind the Play, a video and podcast product of the Hoops Crew that explores the lives of Geelong players, past and present, as well as the off-field figures that are keeping us Geelong strong, as well as really important figures from throughout the industry that have really valuable insights. I'm joined by one of those amazing people today, Dr. Peter Larkins. Welcome to the show.
Nice to be with you, Paul. Thanks for chatting.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting to have a little bit of a chat pre-recording there, and it was nice to just kind of learn, you know, a few little and kind of loosely touch on a few things that we'll discuss in the show there. But really looking forward to having the chat, and thank you very much for coming aboard.
No, look, got a great connection with the Cats from my earliest memories of football, so nice to be able to contribute to something still at this stage in the era that the Cats have been in, which has been pretty good the last decade, to be honest.
Yeah, the last couple of years have been pretty decent. And, you know, I still feel like maybe I've got the blinders on, I don't know, but it still feels like there could be good years ahead, whether they're premiership years, I don't know, but... I still feel like there's plenty of room for success over the coming block of years.
Well, look, I mean, all fans are optimistic pre-season, as they should be.
There's a bit of that.
As we always say in the industry, no one's lost a game at this stage. So everyone's on top of the ladder and undefeated. But, you know, one of the things, I suppose, again, if we just talk about historically, you know, Geelong has defied the odds where it's been often as a club thought that it had its best era and thought that some of its better players had gone, you know, the Tom Harleys, the Lings, the Bartel, yeah. They've gone on and, you know, Geelong will go through a slump. You know, and Geelong's just had this ability through its incredible development of its next tier of players. And so we're always optimistic that they're going to bounce back after 23 was disappointing off the back of 22. But again, you know, footy's a strange beast, and it does make a difference. You know, every year teams that are supposed to do well don't, and then someone comes out and, you know, surprises everyone. But let's be optimistic. We've still got a great squad down at Canadian Park for sure, Paul.
Yeah, certainly the last 20 years or so, really, if we kind of go back to even beginning with 2004 and a prelim final there, it's kind of given Cats supporters reason to think that there's always a chance, even if it doesn't quite work out, there's kind of always a chance. And to your point, there's been that cycling through of talent as the older guard retire and the new group step up. It just seems like, no, I don't want to get too carried away. I'll jinx it or something like that. But it just feels like success is always attainable, I guess, in any given year at the moment.
Yeah, look, we'd be careful not to be blinkers on when we're doing a Geelong show and we're talking about Geelong. But, you know, history would support, you know, that Geelong has a way of overcoming the slump that's traditionally been there. And, you know, if you look, as I said, historically, again, not missing out on finals is something that, you know, we don't want to be looking at. So the concept of how often we've been able to make finals and then do okay and, you know, prelims and things, and unless you're competitive, which is great, you know, for the exposure for the club and for recruiting and sponsorship and things like that. And you're always a chance. I mean, footy, we've seen that, you know, we've seen that with the Bulldogs in 16 when they came from, you know, back of the pack and fell through into the grand final. And, you know, so again, you know, you've got to be competitive, and again, without getting too medical straight up front early in the basketball, you know, you've got to have your best list available, because everyone's got a great list on paper when no one's injured and everyone's come off their pre-season rest or their pre-season or end of season surgery from 23 and gone into 24. But if you look at the way that, you know, the seasons unfold, the teams that do well, the teams that keep their best, you know, 26 or 28 playing. You know, you never get your best two playing the whole time. But once you're digging down into your 37, 38, 39th player on the list. So the secret, of course, is to stay healthy. And that's all part of the management, both on the coaching staff and the sports science and the sports medicine team. You know, that's the secret of any club, is have your best available.
Yeah, and I mean, it's going to be a really interesting thing. And to your point, yeah, keeping everyone fit is hugely important. And we see, unfortunately, we're hearing stories from other clubs of players that have already had some season-ending injuries early on, or very significant ones. When I think about, say, a Jake Boydering, for example, at Carlton in recent days, as of when we record this, bit of a vacuum for everyone watching it. But it can happen very fast. So hopefully things stay good.
Yeah, and you look at McStay at Collingwood coming off, you know, the troubles he had in 23, and they go on and win a flag, and then he does an ACL just, you know, in relatively recent weeks. And Buddy Smith the same, and the Bulldogs, who almost was looking at getting to the Cats at one stage. You know, ACL injuries where, you know, you think you're going to have really signature players like that available, and then suddenly they're not available for an entire season. And so the setbacks that clubs have got to deal with over the coming month as we lead into round one, even, you know, and is going to be important, because you always expect you're going to have your best team to start with, and that's not often the case.
Absolutely. Now, we've obviously spent a bit of time so far talking about present day and I guess some of the present day fortunes of the various different clubs. But before we'll inevitably find our way back there, but I guess skipping back a little bit, for you, when did footy first come into your life? And we know, you know, there's a lot of documentation around the things that you've done in the footy realm, but I guess just that pure consumer side of the game, was it kind of instantaneous? Did it take a while?
I can't remember when it wasn't in my life. And I know that sounds a bit silly, but, you know, I grew up in a little rural property outside Geelong. And, you know, from the age of 4 or 5, I was aware of the footy club. And you know, my uncle was one of the head trainers at Geelong. So, you know, as an 8 or 9 year old, I was down in the club rooms at Geelong learning how to strap an ankle. And, you know, in those days it was pretty primitive medical care in terms of what went on. You know, it was liniment and oranges and, you know, strapping up and a few massage people. But you know, my
back and out you go.
Yeah, you know, the smelling salts were there if you got knocked out. But the thing was that, you know, footy in Geelong was sort of something that you really were aware of, whether you were, you know, sort of in town or a bit out of town like we were. So, again, at, you know, 5 or 6 years of age, I knew about Geelong Footy Club. And as I said, because of my uncle Pat Whelan, I got to go down to the footy club, you know, as a 8-year-old and certainly got the sense of the atmosphere in the rooms. And you know, I had no idea that I'd have a footy connection for that long. It was pretty clear that Geelong was going to be the team that I followed. My dad was very good friends with Frank Costa, who, of course, was so prominent in Geelong as the mayor and then ultimately as the president of the footy club. And so I got to go to the footy a little bit, you know, in my early teenage years, 12, 13, 14. And so the concept of, you know, having the footy connection was there. And the doctor who was one of the main doctors for the Geelong Footy Club, Kevin Threlfall, who came president of the club ultimately, was also our family doctor. So when I got hurt playing footy at school or hurt with my running from my own activities, which fortunately wasn't too often, Paul, the doctor that I went to was the Geelong Footy Club doctor, which I thought was a pretty cool job to have, of course.
Absolutely.
And so once I got into the medical course, I sort of kept in touch with Kevin and had an opportunity to get a little bit of experience behind the scenes footy even before I became a doctor.
Was there, I guess, in those really early days, and obviously there was such a Geelong presence around you, were there any voices in the ear trying to tempt you to, I guess, throw your support behind another club, whether it was a family member, and was it Geelong all the way?
No, there was never much influence. I mean, I had one or two strays in our family, black sheep, who one supported North Melbourne. So I said they obviously had read the direction of the stripes incorrectly because they got the hoops connected with the verticals wrong. And my niece, who started following Collingwood because Renee Kink, number 36, was running around as the Incredible Hulk, and she was just a, you know, 13, 14 year old who was, I think, besotted by the fact that he was such a good looking dude, Renee. So there wasn't many strays in our family away from the blue and white to follow in that direction. So no pressure on me, and it would have taken a lot, I suppose, to have changed it anyway.
Now, so many people know about your history within football, but I think something that maybe gets overlooked a little bit by people from time to time is the extensive background in steeplechase in particular, the athletic background there. So, I guess let's kind of wade into that a little bit. And I guess when did that really, I guess, fall on your radar? Because you've won steeplechase over many, many years in national competitions. So how did that, I guess, become a viable option for you? And I guess where did the interest first begin?
Well, I was very fortunate growing up in Geelong because we've just talked about it. It's a very sports city, not just based around and footy or VFL it was at the time when I was at school. And I went to St. Joey's, CBC, which historically has been a very strong school academically as well as from a sport point of view. And we boast as a school more AFL senior players now than any other school in Australia. So whether you're going back to, you know, to the McMaster time or then the Barry Stoneham's and, you know, right through the Cameron Ling, Jimmy Bartel, and, you know, we've had such a scarlet. So it was a great footy school, but it also, I had a brother who was very good at athletics and my dad was involved at Landy Field, which was the running track down at Geelong as well. And in fact, we knew John Landy as a family friend. And so I had a real interest in running, and my choice of sports at school was so extreme. So I played cricket, athletics and footy as my main sports as a schoolboy, and was fortunate enough to play, you know, right through the first 18 at school, and under 12, under 15 footy. But athletics was also probably the sport that I was best at, and was winning, you know, the school athletics trophies. And by the age of 4 to 15, I'd already been selected in the under 17 Victorian team as a distance runner over 800 metres. So I started off over 800 metres. But the reason I got into steeplechasing, for those listeners who may not appreciate, I wasn't a jockey riding the horses. Steeplechase is a running event, a distance running event at senior level, 3,000 metres at least, where you're jumping over the barriers in the water jump. Pretty famous. It's the hardest event on the running program. I always say to people, Paul, it's, you know, you've got to be able to jump and run and sprint and all those sort of things. But
lots of disciplines involved.
Yeah, and the reason that I was able to get in, so as a middle distance runner, I transferred easily into the steeplechasing where there was jumping, because down at Landy Field, my coach, Rudy Hochreiter, was quite famous in Geelong as an athletics coach, and he really got us to do everything, including hurdles and sprints as yep. part of our athletic training. So hurdling came naturally to me at school. In fact, I competed in state championships as a 12 and 14 and 15-year-old as a hurdler. And so the steeplechase, which does involve jumping over barriers, came pretty naturally to me. And my middle distance running was better than as I got a bit older. You know, I became a bit slow over 800 and I became the 1500 metre and then the steeplechase at 3000. So in this pathway of footy versus athletics, athletics was something that I was sort of getting a bit more enjoyment out of and success at. So I went into that direction. And as you said, I was lucky enough to have 10 years at the international level and between junior and senior championships, I think 11 Australian titles over steeplechase event, as well as some over 15 and 800 metres. So the athletics background was pretty strong, but sport background was pretty strong. So it really gave me my interest in the medical side of sport all the way through, because I'd really been a consumer in the sense that I'd been an athlete.
Yeah.
So when I was looking at things I wanted to do, I was always interested in high performance. So whether it was nutrition and training and recovery and equipment. So the whole concept of what made sport successful was something that I grew up with really as a 9, 10, 11-year-old. So it was pretty easy to transfer that into the sports medicine direction when I got into study time.
And we should absolutely acknowledge also the Olympic and Commonwealth Games appearances as well, which, you know, it's no mean yeah. feat to be able to participate in that. So, yeah. I mean, a massive yeah. congratulations for that too.
Thank you. Look, it was not something you have to set targets, of course, but it's not something as a 12-year-old. You know, I never was running around a 12-year-old at Landy Field saying I'm going to run in the Olympics at some stage. It really just hit me between the eyes when I was about 17 or 18, and my coach, when I transferred to study in Melbourne at 17, I was at university, and I transferred from running in Geelong to running for initially Melbourne University Club, but then Box Hill. And the coach there said, you know, look, we could have the Olympics was 2 years away. And he said, you know, we could have you at the Olympics. And I thought he was dreaming, but basically just with hard work and training and, you know, picking an event where it was something I was really cut out to do with my distance running yeah. at a bit of speed. So ultimately, I was very, very fortunate, you know, to within a year of sort of putting my head down as a 19-year-old, by 20 and 21, I was already at international level.
And how do you reflect on some of those, especially, you know, the big marquee things like the Olympics? I guess, what were some of those experiences like? Because very few, regardless of what sport they might be involved in, very few will make it to that level. So I guess, how yeah. do you reflect upon that period? What was the experience even like in the first place? A bit of a whirlwind at the time?
Yeah, look, it is. It's a long time ago, Paul. That's the first thing I'll say. But look, it's an extraordinary experience. I mean, you look back and say, wow, did I really even do that? And you know, of course, at the time, and without wanting to date myself too much, we're not talking about recent Olympics. We're talking about Olympics when there really wasn't all the infrastructure to support finance, you know, amateur athletes. It was amateur athletics at the time, you know. And so the concept of having to train and then get yourself overseas to prepare if you wanted to prepare, but then the way the Olympics ran in those days that you had to be in Australia in the month or two before the Olympics and everyone travelled in the same plane. I mean, the first time I went to Olympics was Montreal 1976, just to put some historic dates on it.
Yeah.
We went on a charter flight, you know, out of Melbourne. It was 8 degrees in Melbourne in the middle of winter in July, and we flew all night and ended up in Montreal. It was 34 degrees and stinking hot. There was no pre-season, if you like, so we didn't get to do what the current athletes do. So I look back at it and I thought, gee, how primitive it was, because we were really coming in our off season and turning up to play in a grand final without a practice match, so to speak, in footy terms, right? And so it wasn't a great experience. I mean, you know, in terms of the way we prepared, whereas it's totally different now for our athletes in the last, sort of 20 years or so, where they get to spend time in Europe, whether they're the hockey team or the rowing team or the swimmers, and so they prepare pretty well. But to answer your question, it was just an amazing experience because here you are with the best of the best in the world. You're living in an Olympic village and you've got a world champion over there and a world record holder over there, and you're watching other sports at the absolute best being played. And so whilst I didn't come away with, a lot of gold or silver medals out of the Commonwealth or Olympic Games, I came away with incredible experience, incredible knowledge of the sport and an understanding of the way other countries were working, I suppose, in terms of the way they had support around their athletes, the way they prepared. So in terms of my future goals or future connections, that experience was invaluable for me because I'd really lived the experience as an international performer. And so I knew the demands that athletes needed to do to get things right. So when I went into the sports medicine world, I was able to put myself in the shoes of the patients that I treated, initially the elite people, but these days it's just everyone that I look after or just people trying to stay fit and stay active. But the experience of mixing with the Sebastian Coes of the world and the Steve Ovetts and the John Walkers, and these are the guys that had the world records over 800 meters, 1500 meters, and I got to compete on what's called the Grand Prix circuit. So the Grand Prix circuit is each August and September, October in Europe, where you get to compete in the best meetings every year. So whether it was Zurich or Dusseldorf or London and Rome and Helsinki. So as an Australian champion, you sort of almost got a wild card entry into those events.
Nice.
Yeah. And so I was really on that circuit which was pretty tough on the studies because I was disappearing from university for 6 weeks or so every August and coming back at the end of September. But to me, it was part of a unique experience to improve myself. You had to compete overseas because there really wasn't enough competition in Australia for me. And it allowed me to travel at a time when sports medicine was developing pretty strongly in those countries. And at that time, that time I was competing, Paul, I was able to go to East Germany. I was able to go to Russia, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria. So it was at a time when it was quite restricted, but as an athlete, you got to go and compete in some of those places. So I had a real sense of what was going on in the medical support system, some of which was dodgy, as we've obviously found out when we look back at the doping and the drug scene, particularly. Well, yeah. So I had a great insight into what was going on. As a medical student, my head used to fall off when I would be watching and hearing about what some of these athletes were taking and doing. But in those days, the anti-doping system was very, very primitive. And so I was pretty frustrated that the people out there were getting away with as much as they did. And historically, we've seen that, particularly, say, Russia and East Germany and that side of things. So it gave me a great insight into sports medicine, the good and the bad. And it really motivated me to want to be working in that field because I thought, well, why wouldn't we have a great sports medicine culture in Australia going forward? When we look at all the sport we've got, whether it's cricket or whether it's tennis or whether it's footy, whether it's rowing or hockey, you name it, we're a sporting nation. But we didn't have a really strong sports medicine discipline or specialty in that field of medicine. So that was something I just set my sights on heading into that field as a result of my experience as an athlete.
And so I guess how was that period of study though? And obviously, as you say, kind of interrupted from time to time with different meets and events that you'd be competing in. But the experience of studying, learning about the craft, and I guess being able to draw upon those experiences and things that you witnessed, both good and bad, I guess, how did that kind of inform that whole block of study that you would have completed?
Well, it gave me the opportunity to develop some network of people. So when I did have opportunity as a medical student to do what's called elective, where you get time to go away and perhaps do some studies overseas, I was able to make connections with some of the doctors I'd met who were the Olympic doctors, particularly in Canada and in the UK and in the US. And so I was able to sort of, make a connection, say, hey, can I come and spend a month, under your wing and sort of, shadow you around. And so those opportunities were came, including going to East Germany, I might say, at one stage as well, before the Berlin Wall came down. So that was, it was impossible to get into East Germany as a Westerner. But I had a good connection with the Australian doctor here who'd been friends with the East German doctor. So there was one little special period of time
where I
even got to do that. So that was all just little pieces of it, time here, time there. There was no one place you could go and spend a year. I did that later on after I graduated from medicine because, again, there was no postgraduate course in Australia in that specialty of sports medicine as there is now for young doctors who are coming through and want to specialise in sports medicine. They can do that in Australia. But at the time, I had to go overseas. But I was fortunate enough at the end of my medical school days, graduation, once I finished the hospital time, to win a Sir Robert Menzies Fellowship. And Sir Robert Menzies, our ex-Prime Minister, was a great fan of sport. And so his family trust had set up a scholarship, one in, for law and one in medicine. And I was able to snag one of those, which gave me a chance to go away for a year and really pick the eyes out of some of those places I was saying to you about. It gave me the opportunity to come back with a little bit more knowledge than I would have gained by spending time in Australia.
Yeah, and obviously a huge honour as well along the way.
I was fortunate to get two scholarships, Hume Turnbull Fellowship and then Sir Robert Menzies, and that just allowed me to get away. I came back here with really the intention of trying, and right at the time the sports medicine was really just starting to roll along. The Institute of Sport hadn't even started when I first came back from those studies, but I got involved with them right at the beginning. And so historically we'd had a little bit of a sports medicine culture in Australia since the 56 Olympics. And so there had been an organisation set up. And so I joined them as a student member. But it really wasn't until the Institute of Sport started, you know, in the early 80s that we really started to really probably support our athletes properly at the elite level. Even footy clubs in those days, just to bring the footy flavour back in again, Paul, they really just had part-time GP doctors who were, yep, you know, had practice at Geelong or their practice in Melbourne or Carlton, and they'd look after the club on the weekend. But they were, it was voluntary. There were always the trainers who were voluntary. You might have had a physio or two. So the structure and support around an AFL club now doesn't resemble anything like it did when I first started working at Geelong, helping Kevin Threlfall as an assistant doctor in the 1980s, because that was my first footy club that I worked at was Geelong. Yep. And so the whole concept of the way sports medicine, sports science, the nutrition, the strength and conditioning, the psychology, the recovery, obviously the injury management, that whole
it's
thing
is exponentially different.
Well, in Australia, it's developed. You know, we are looked upon as one of the nations that does that the best. And whether, you know, and a lot of people do want to come out here and study our systems now. So we do a great job, not just with footy, but, you know, whether it's our tennis players or whether it's our hockey team or whether it's our Matildas girls, you know, in the women's world soccer team, or whether, you know, any of our teams, we have elite medical and science care behind our elite athletes.
Yeah, and I mean, as you say, that kind of takes time. It was a far more primitive state not that long ago when we look at it in the grand scheme of things. But that exponential rise and increase of what we've seen over the last few decades alone has positioned the country exceptionally well.
Yeah, look, as I said, you can go back to the Institute of Sport, and, you know, which is the 80s, just for those listeners who aren't familiar with that, when the Institute of Sport opened up. But in terms of footy, again, just to be specific on that, I mean, I had the chance to work at Geelong for 6 years as an assistant doctor to the club doctors down there. And then I got a tap on the shoulder when Adelaide Crows came into the competition. And they began in 1990, and I knew the Olympic swimming doctor, Brian Sando, and he was the doctor for the Adelaide Crows because he'd been a Sandful footy doctor as well as his work with Olympics, Paul, over there.
Yes.
They needed someone in Victoria who knew the Victorian scene, you know, where the hospitals were and where the specialists were, and if a player had to stay behind because they had broken ribs. So Brian asked me if I'd help out with the Crows. So I had another 7 years working down on the benches, you know, so to speak, on the sidelines in the footy. So I did 6 years Geelong, 7 years at the Crows. And it was during that time at the Crows that I reckon, which was they came in 1990 and they won their first flag in 97. That's when really I think the sports science started to really come in a lot more, and the medical support got a lot better, and people get paid a little bit, you know. But it's totally different in 2024 than it was back then, even for
magnitudes. You obviously just highlighted there the different experiences at the two different clubs. Now, as a Geelong supporter along the way, you obviously got to see and be witness to work alongside some legends of the club there, you know, on the playing side and off field as well. Similar sort of story for the Crows, some wonderful players and people that went through the Crows there as well. What were some of those experiences like along the way working with both different clubs, and obviously one of them being a club that you'd supported from a very young age?
Yeah, well, it was pretty exciting. I mean, Gary Ablett Sr. was playing when I went down to work. He'd come across from Hawthorn, of course, and he was really just starting. So I started at Geelong helping Kevin Threlfall in 1984, And so, you know, Gary Ablett was starting to be the star right through the 80s, right up to his magnificent 89 grand final, which we don't talk about the result, but the fact that he was, you know, he did so well on the day with his performance against the Hawks that in that the best grand final of all time. So you know, but yeah, there were so many good players down at Geelong at that time. And you know, I had John Devine was coaching at one stage, and then Tommy Hafey, who was an interesting cat to work with, no pun intended, because he was a different fellow. He didn't believe in doctors. You know, if you broke your leg, you just got up there, son, and went back out there. And I remember when Mickey Turner, who did his ACL, and he came back from an ACL injury, and Tommy didn't believe that there was such thing as the ACLs. You know, it's only a little ligament. It can't be important in a knee. You know,
how can it break down the whole person? Yeah, what are you talking about?
How can a soccer from playing footy when it's such a tiny little ligament? You go, you know, your doctors are all making it up. So, you know, it was an interesting time there. But, again, and the Crows were quite different because the Crows were pretty much a state side when you think about it. When they came in, you know, they had the Charmans and they had Modra and they, you know, they had the Rusciutos. I mean, it was seriously like a South Australian state side. And because they were funded so well, their rooms, their gym, their training facilities were the best I'd ever seen by any club across all the clubs at that stage. But then everyone wanted to copy them, you know, and so that sort of grew and grew and grew through the 90s into the 2000s where the support around came through. But, yeah, look, it's just, I mean, you just admire athletes. I mean, I've been lucky to work with athletes across a whole range of sports. So when you say what was it like, you just sit back and watch these guys play footy at a level that I was never going to play at, but and you know, and sort of trying to help them understand that, you know, preparing for a sport, you've got a whole lot of things you've got to get right. It's not just the training on the footy track, it's the recovery, it's the sleep, it's the nutrition. And I think all that started my background in Olympic sports had taught me that long before I sort of got into the footy world, and the footy world adopted that afterwards, because I think individual athletes like track and field and swimmers have already had that mindset for a long time, but footy really came into that probably in the late 90s and 2000s, and much more sophisticated now with the support staff that's behind a footy team these days, as I said before.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And so I guess we discussed these experiences at the Cats, at the Crows, the different facilities, those sorts of things, and we're starting to kind of creep towards the media era.
Yeah.
And so how did that first emerge? We kind of spoke about before we started recording some of the, I guess, the stepping in with Triple M, and then obviously there was Channel 9 and a range of different experiences since. But how did that first kick off?
Well, it kicked off when I first came back from those travels overseas when I won those fellowships, and I came back and I again joined the committee of the Victorian Sports Medicine Federation, as it was called. And because I'd been overseas and was pretty contemporary with what was happening around the world, they sort of made me the media spokesperson whenever there was a big story in
push you out there.
To comment on, because, you know, I came back and I was the youngest guy by so far on those committees. They're all the old guys, and, you know, and I was pretty much a full-time sports medicine person. I was up to date with all the doping code, you know, some of the latest treatments overseas. And so when there was a big injury, regardless of the sport, whether it was a knee injury in a footballer or whether it was a head injury in boxing, I got trotted out both by the AMA, the Australian Medical Association, and Sports Medicine Australia. And so the journalists sort of got to know me as the guy to go to when you wanted to make a comment or have some translation done about, you know, what was this drug that the cyclists were using in the Tour de France, never heard of. So I was able to, at least, if you look back in that time, long before the AFL Triple M stuff, I was sort of doing that on a piecemeal basis. And one of the young journalists that used me quite a bit at that time was an up-and-coming bloke called Eddie Maguire. You've probably never heard of him, Paul, but there's this bloke called
Eddie. No idea. What do you do for Geelong?
Yeah, Eddie was a great fan of athletics, so he knew my athletics background. He was a great fan of athletics, and he knew my background at elite sport, Olympic-wise. And he'd seen me, you know, and he'd done a few interviews. So I historically, Triple M got its contract in 1996 to broadcast radio games on the FM network. Never been done before, right?
Yeah.
And I got a call from Eddie Maguire, and he said, if you sign with the Crows, this was in 96, and I said, no, not yet. He says, don't sign. We're going to broadcast footy. So what Eddie was doing was handpicking a team of people. So it had Sam Newman, and had Steve Quatermain, Jason Dunstall, doing, but he had six or seven people he wanted, and what he wanted my role to be was to be down on the sidelines telling the fans at home, you know, when Paul James limps off the field holding his knee, you know, what's the injury, how long is he going to be out for? And so it was that instantaneous information that the fans, so Eddie knew that I'd worked Geelong 6 years, Crows 7 years. He knew I knew footy injuries, but he also knew that I wasn't scared of a microphone because of that other stuff I'd done. So I swapped across at the beginning of 97 to do Triple M work. And prior to that, again, just backing up a year or two, Paul, the footy show had begun in 1994 on Channel 9, the Thursday night footy show. And then I'd done one or two segments a year there. Again, just it was a big story. I think, you know, Jason Dunstall did his knee out at Waverley in one of the games. And so I had to come in and explain what an ACL was, you know, again. So I had a little connection with Channel 9 footy show, but the Triple M thing really became that stepped up from, you know, being working with the Crows on the games that they played in Victoria to suddenly I'm doing a Friday night game and then I'm doing a Saturday game and a Saturday night game and a Sunday game. And then I got a call in the second year from Steve Perkin on the Sunday footy show because he used to, at the end of each weekend, I used to do a little roundup on Triple M of what the key injuries were, like who dislocated their shoulder and who'd broken their ankle and who'd done a hamstring.
Oh, I recall some of them, yeah.
And so it was sort of like I used to pick the six or eight key injuries, if you like, of the weekend, and I'd do a little summary of what happened this weekend on the radio. And it was after the Sunday game on the Triple M Sunday game that we did. And Steve was driving home in his car and he'd listened to it for a few months in a row. And then he rang me one Sunday night and said, you know what you did this, you know, just did. And then he said, what, can you come in next Sunday morning and do that on the Sunday footy show? And I said, do what? He says, just do that little summary. So I turned up there the following week at Channel 9, the studios, and they had this little desk set up in the corner. They had a skeleton behind me, they had a stethoscope around it. And Max Walker was the host of the footy show. Max, Lou Richards was on it, of course. Sam Newman was on it. Mark Jackson was there that day. Mel Brown was over to it. And I'm saying, well, what do I do? He says, oh, when the camera goes on, just do what you did. So I had no training, no support whatsoever. They just went to the injury segment and I'd memorized the injuries of that. So that was the start of my broadcast of the Sunday footy show. And that went on for the next
thrown six, in the deep end.
Yeah, yeah. So I was doing the Triple M, then I did the Channel 9, and then ultimately there was, you know, it sort of moved. Then I started writing the Herald Sun, asked me to write a column, the injury of the week. So each Monday you'd pick up the paper and you could read about who'd had the ankle injury or the hamstring. So I did that sort of each week. So it just sort of expanded between that beginning with Triple M and then Channel 9 connection. And it took me into the web was starting to appear. So AFL.com was coming along. And so I started to do a little segment with them. And it just, you know, the media coverage of footy in the time from when I started in that first 6 or 7 years, it just was the explosion time for coverage. So Triple M was there and obviously ABC and 3AW doing it. Channel 9 had it. Channel 7 had the broadcasting, but Channel 9 had the footy show on the Thursday and the Sunday footy show, which was had a really strong following. So I got pretty well known as the guy that would be, you know, the doc who would be doing the footy injury stuff. And it was just great. It was just a unique opportunity. I mean, here I was, a guy, love footy, love sports medicine. Got to work beside Sam Newman, you know, as I said, Steve Quatermain, Rex Hunt, Jason, you know, all the guys, Danny Frawley, you know, all those guys that I worked with over many, many years across the networks and
icons, you know, of the media side.
Well, I mean, they were the giants at the time, and you know, and still are in terms of historically what they did. So the media coverage, I think, of footy, we talked before, Paulie, but you and I, about, you know, podcasts and YouTubes and, you know, but in those days they didn't exist that either. Now there's shows, you know, you've got so many shows on TV apart from the footy show, which is gone, but, you know, you had Channel 7 doing Game Day and then you've got the Front Bar and you had AFL 360 because once streaming came along with Fox Sports, again, suddenly you had footy channels, Fox Footy, yeah. You know, my goodness, I worked with them at one stage, you know, so the opportunity for people to get information, and one of the critical things, and you and I spoke about it before, one of the things that determines success is having your best team available. So my ability, I suppose, to, you know, guess, and I wasn't guessing because I'd come off a pretty strong 20-year history of being a specialist in sports medicine. So I knew the difference between a dislocated shoulder and a broken collarbone. I knew what a mild ankle injury was and a bad ankle injury. So I guess my ability to predict in rough terms the amount of time a player was going to miss became critical for a whole lot of people.
It's a really valuable resource for these networks.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I know the opposition clubs used to tune into my medical report because if Nick Riewoldt had hurt his knee in a game, you know, that weekend, and the team, Carlton was playing, you know, St Kilda the next week, Carlton guys would be listening to what I'd say about Nick Riewoldt because they'd report back to the coach.
Absolutely.
As to whether know, and often the clubs, and they're still much the same, I've got to say, Paul, the clubs like to cloud the truth a little bit when they're giving out an injury. Look, we have to wait for the scan, or we're unsure what the injury is, or we're optimistic he's not going to miss too much time, and then you find the guy misses 3 months, right? So I didn't have to have that filter on when I gave out information to people, because I wasn't behaving to any club. My job was to keep the public educated. I was getting paid by Triple M or Channel 9 to give information that no one else could give, particularly live during the game. And so there was a lot of pressure on to get it right. But equally, you know, I generally found that, you know, most clubs were not wanting to tell the truth very often about their injuries for obvious reasons, because they don't want the position to know, or they don't want fans to know. But and to this day, that still happens a little bit. And
it's one of those things, and actually you'd be curious to kind of pick your brain a little bit about it. I think about the 2023 season, and I think about Geelong specifically. Now, this is a one-eyed platform, but the short-term, medium-term, long-term, and really trying to obscure the number of potentially number of weeks. And, of course, as you say, there was always still some intent to try and hide things a little bit back there. But this was kind of I felt like a next level. What did you kind of make of that? Certainly as a consumer and someone who doesn't have the knowledge you do, it did make things a lot harder to try and get a look in.
New terminology came on, and I think the AFL has already
squashed it.
Addressed that. Let me say that, because it's so vague. It's a way of clubs not having to really give out information. If they know someone's got a stress fracture and in their midfoot, and then they're going to miss, you know, depending on which bone it is, they're going to miss 6, 8, 10 weeks. The club's going to say it's short to medium term. Now, what does that mean? Medium term, that can be half a season, right?
Cam Guthrie kind of fit that bill over the course of the year, where he kind of fluctuated from short to medium. Now, his circumstances did change at one point.
But to be fair to clubs, I mean, sometimes it's very hard to predict when an injury is unfolding how long it's going to take. And on the day itself, there's enormous pressure on the doctors to try and tell the coach whether the players, first of all, he's going to be able to come back the second half of the game if he's got a tight hamstring or a bit of a dodgy shoulder. But when they do get an injury, as to how quickly they're going to recover, because different players recover at different times. So I have some sympathy for the clubs being a little bit vague with their predictions. But you know, there's a certain pattern to these footy injuries. There's only so many footy injuries that can occur. You know, I've seen them all in 30 years, Paul. So there's a time frame that's pretty consistent with those injuries. So I was able to be a bit more precise, much more so than the clubs, the clubs would say that someone's going to miss 2 to 3 weeks, and I'd say it's 4 to 6. And when it turned out to be 6 or 7, you know, people would say, oh, how did you know better than the club doctor? And I said, well, the club doctor did know, but he wasn't allowed to say. But now they're not putting weeks, they're putting these vague, you know, periods of time. And I think in terms of, and I don't think it should be geared around the gambling or the betting agencies or the super coach teams, but people get really upset, because I know all the super coach people used to follow my predictions, because if they're trying to trade players in, there you go. Well,
I'm absolutely in that boat.
So if a club says that Dusty Martin's got a tight hamstring, and then I say he's going to miss 6. Well, people are going, well, who's right? You know, is Doc Larkin 6 weeks? Am I going to trade Dusty Martin out now because he's not available, or am I going to wait and see what the club says? But that shouldn't be what the information's for. It should be just thing.
That shouldn't be what's driving it. That is absolutely like a meta spin-off of these things, whether it is gambling, whether it is
of it is gambling, you know, because, you know, people are betting on, you know, the next 4 weeks ahead of time at the games or whatever. So to know that the ruckman's not going to be available, to know that a Tom Hawkins is going to miss a month, or the Cameron's out with 2 broken ribs after Gary Rowan's, you know, knocked him into the next suburb in that collision. He did knock him out. So
some of the steel frames, the way Jeremy's face just got warped in that collision
So that predictability of how much time's going to miss, a lot of it's geared towards the gambling and the betting, as plus, you know, super coach and teams and all that sort of thing. And I understand that. But it's just the fans themselves, they want to know too, you know. And sometimes the players want to know. They want more specific information from the club itself. I remember Shane Crawford, not to talk about too many specific injuries, I don't want to, but Shane Crawford, obviously famous Hawthorn player, Brownlow medalist.
Yep.
he did one of those famous syndesmosis, that funny ankle injury where you get a particular ligament in the centre. And, you know, I get accused of making up names, you know, for things, but these are all medical terms that I try to translate into everyday language, Paul, for people. But I wrote a story about Shane Crawford and his syndesmosis injury in the Herald Sun, and I had a diagram of where the ligament was, and I talked about how long it takes to get better. And I ran into Shane literally a few days later because we shared some mutual friends. He said, Doc, I had to read about my own injury in the paper to understand what I'd done to myself, because he said even at the footy club, they couldn't be quite sure to explain. And so I said, I read your article. And I said, well, Shane, it's something that, you know, it's an injury that people don't understand very well. So you know, those sort of aspects, sometimes the players would be, you know, they generally get a feel for it these days, but the public don't get given the correct information.
Are there any, and I guess feel free to name a scenario if there's one that springs to mind. You obviously discussed the fact that there was injuries where you could, you know, tell pretty reliably with years and decades of experience, okay, that's a whatever, it's a shoulder and it's going to be 6 to 8 weeks, or it's going to be this and it's going to be whatever. Are there any that stick out to you on the flip side where you're like, I got that, I completely misread that, I completely underestimated that? Like, are there any that kind of really stick out that, oh, okay, because, you know, it's natural, of course, you know, mistakes can happen on both sides of the fence. Are there any that really stick out?
No one's 100%. You know, prediction right sort of thing. I mean, it look, fortunately there weren't too many, to be honest. I mean, I remember that, again, Wayne Carey had a really bad ankle sprain, and it went one side then the other side, so that double sprain, both sides of the ankle, medial and lateral ligaments, to give them their proper names, Paul. And I saw him in the rooms afterwards, because part of my great job that I had in this Triple M role wasn't just talking about who'd got a sore hamstring or that. I used to go down the rooms and interview the best player or the coach in the losing room. So I was really behind the scenes, and I really got to know the player managers and the coaches, and all the players knew me by name. But anyway, so I could see the size of Wayne Carey's ankle, and he was hardly putting any weight on it. So I think I did a story on the Sunday Footy Show the next day to say that, you know, it was likely that he was going to miss between 4 and 6 weeks. And in fact, I might have even done the Herald Sun article about it. But then the physios from the club cut that out. They stuck it up at the footy club rooms and said to Wayne Carey, right, Doc Larkins reckons you're going to make 4 to 6 weeks. We're going to have you back in 3. And he played week 3. And they always joked to me saying, you know, that really motivated him because that injury should have taken that amount of time. So that was a funny one with Wayne, where they used that as a motive. They used my prediction of how long
it was going
to make him come back as a carrot, to make him come back a lot more quickly. Look, no, there aren't too many. I mean, you know, sometimes I would, you know, the time frame might have been slightly out, but there's a lot of pressure, because, you know, one of the reasons Eddie got me into that job originally, and then I did it, of course, for the TV as well, as, you know, that they were wanting me to sort of, as a player limps off the ground, they were basically wanting me to know what the diagnosis was, you know, what scan he was going to have, who he was going to see, and when he was going to play again. Now, it had only happened 30 seconds ago. Like, the club hadn't assessed him at that time. So I'm thinking, fair go here. So, but once, you know, once the player came off, as long as I could, two things that really helped me with my job, Paul. One was a replay of the incident, so I could actually see which way the body twisted or which way the ankle or the shoulder had gone.
Yeah.
And I had the advantage of, certainly when I was doing the TV broadcasting, that I'd have a monitor to be able to do that long before the clubs had the laptops down on the sidelines like they have to now, where you see them, the doctors checking the incident.
Monitoring all the time, yeah.
Particularly it's a head injury, but even a knee or an ankle, but I had that. And secondly, once they came off the ground, and these days, I think I changed it a little bit, I'm told by the clubs anyway, these days they take them down rooms out of sight. So you see them going down, you know, underneath, so the TV cameras can't see them or that. But generally in those days when I started the first 10 years, the doctors would be examining your knee on the sidelines or your hamstring or your shoulder. So I knew from my experience as a doctor the difference between an AC joint and a collarbone and a dislocated shoulder. So, you know, whilst everyone knew it was a shoulder that they were checking, I'd be able to say which particular part of the shoulder, because different parts of those injuries result in, you know, some you can go back on the time, some you can strap up, some you're not going to play the rest of the day. So the immediacy of having to make a decision as to what the injury was and how likely it's likely to be out there was something that I guess I prided myself on getting that right 80% of the time.
And I mean, 80% of the time is a pretty extraordinary strike rate, right? So I must say, again, as someone who's purely consuming the footy at this point and would, you know, listen to any sort of piece of feedback that would come in about my beloved Cats, I'd always put a lot of weight in the things that you would say, and it was really valuable when it comes to those meta things like the super coaches and those sort of things. But also just, you know, as a fan that wants to see my team go well, to have the feedback come from you, okay, I can take that to the bank as much as you can ever take these sort of things, because there is a human variable to the whole thing.
So, I mean, look, when I started, you know, I mean, Dipper, Paul, you know, DP Domenico was doing the Channel 9 broadcasting as the, you know, the sideline commentator. And I was there with Triple M. There were no other radio stations. By the time I finished, I'd looked there was SEN on the left, there was ABC, there was Indigenous Radio, there was, of course, 3AW, K-Rock. You know, so suddenly I had like eight teammates, they're all with microphones, all trying to listen in. But I was the only one with a medical background who'd, one, been off the background of a sporting career myself. Secondly, I had a medical career, and I had an AFL medical career, and I had media experience. So
media training as well.
So that sort of combination, I guess, gave me a little bit more of a heads up about what was happening, you know. But and these days, because I'm not doing that job anymore, I just do freelance stuff and work in a slightly different clinical field, still work in the medical world. I listen to the other sideline broadcasters having a guess or making a comment, and, you know, and sometimes if I've seen the incident, it's getting frustrating for me sitting home on a Saturday night with a, you know, a pizza and a glass of red, and I'm watching the Cats play, and then the commentator, I won't name names to protect the guilty, Paul, but you know, they make a comment about it's a lower leg injury, or it's a shoulder injury, when it's actually their elbow or their wrist, you know, and I can see the difference from my training days, but that's the difference. They're not expected to know that. They don't have the eye for it because they don't do it as a career or as a job. So it's funny watching it now. And as I said, quite often now the player will go straight down the race, and so you don't get to see.
They try to obscure it. Yeah.
The club's gone A from the TV. And every now and again, you will get that little capture because the CCTV exists.
Yeah, you see them as they're walking through the room. Yeah.
You see the player grabbing the back of the hamstring as he walks in, or he's pointing to the thing. And that was the thing. You know, when I did work those games, I had to be watching all the body language, because I wasn't there to watch the footy. I was there to watch the injuries. And so whilst the big contest would happen over there and there'd be a big crash of players and the ball would go down, the ball would head off, and, of course, the commentators are talking about where the ball's gone. I'm watching behind the player to see who gets
behind.
Who's getting up slowly, who's a bit staggery, or who's grabbing the shoulder, because that'll give me an insight to watch them for the next few minutes to see if that amounted to something. So quite often you just got that 5 or 10 second glimpse of which part of the body with the injury occurred, and especially when the players come off, because, you know, body language is a big thing, and lip reading and body language were the two things that got me through a lot of that stuff I was doing.
Brilliant work with the little behind the play plug in there along the way too. Really, really appreciate dropping that name there too. So I guess you spoke about yourself there. You've kind of moved away from the scene a little bit there. We will see, as you say, you're kind of working in a bit of a freelance capacity. We see on social media, even whether it's tweets or whatever, from time to time, commentary around different injuries that surface. I guess, what is this period post that direct ongoing involvement with the AFL been like for you? And, I guess, even on that day-to-day and totally personal level, when do I need to say my piece? When do I need to just...
Yeah, I've got to pull myself back a little bit, because, you know, one of the advantages of being at the games and seeing things unfold live is you have a much better feel for before you make a comment or have a guess or, you know, an estimate of what the injury is. But so just backing off a little bit again, I'm still working at Epworth Sports Medicine, so I'm the director of sports medicine there. I'm working most days of the week seeing people with a sore knee and a sore shoulder. I'm not seeing the footy players, but I'm seeing the people that just want to play golf or walk their dog or be active. So my sort of background in that orthopedic and sports medicine area is still very active in day-to-day practice. Plus, I've also got a corporate business where I look at the value of healthy living and looking at the way exercise. So all the things we learn as an athlete, sleep, nutrition, training, recovery, the things we talked about before, and we talk about high performance in sport, I've also got a business where I educate people on how to be high performance in life, you know, making sure that you look after yourself, your mental health, your physical health, your spiritual health. So I've got two medical fields that I'm still working on, But to answer the question about the footy, it's really challenging now because I tend to not go to a lot of live footy, but I watch it on TV. But you only see what the TV shows. You don't see behind the scenes. You don't see what happens on the sideline. So I still occasionally put out a little bit of a tweet on the Saturday night footy if there's something happens, particularly if I'm have a different agreement from the or a different opinion from the broadcasters that they might have put out, you know, because they might be saying, you know, as I said, they might say it's a lower leg injury, and I can see that it's a thigh or a quad or a hamstring from my interpretation of it. So I'll often just make a little comment. No, I won't criticize. I'll just say, oh, look, Paul James looks like he might be finished for the night. It looks like a reasonably high level hamstring strain, and you know, and then half an hour later or so, when you're not back on the ground, it sort of evolves that way. So, but I'm pretty cautious that I don't, because it's a lot harder when you're not there. So the advantage I had was being live at the game, as I said, seeing the sideline examination, seeing the players' reaction. Whereas when I'm watching it, you know, on Fox Footy or with the broadcaster, they really follow the game. They don't follow the injured player. They might briefly, you know, give you a side shot where they go back to the bench and they'll see, you know, the doctor having a look at Jeremy Cameron's, you know, hamstring. But it's like an instantaneous shot, or sometimes the trainers will be standing there blocking the view of the camera deliberately. They do that so that the cameras can't see. So I'm put out far less information these days than I did back in the days when I was working there, Paul, for reasons of accuracy. Yeah. I never used to guess, right? So there were one of the things in that job that I had, you know, because often the producer would be in your ear saying, you know, because I say, look, I didn't really see. I mean, he's gone down the race. Well, just have a guess. What do you think it is? And I had to say to the producers, you know, I don't guess. You know, my reputation is based on accuracy. Yeah. I don't guess. I'm not going to guess whether he's got a calf injury or a knee injury, you know, because that's I never did that. Let the other broadcasters guess, you know, I used to say to them. So that's why I've got to be careful when I'm doing tweets now, that if I can see a clear vision of it and they do nice replays. And I think, you know, there's so many different cameras at the ground now, Paul, as you know, and the angles that they show. And if they've got time,
we'll see the picture-in-picture thing while the game is still continuing. You see that little picture-in-picture shot as well.
Player limping off, you know, and they're carrying him off, and they've got that in the corner while the game's going on. So if I can see, you know, a reasonable sort of view of what I think's going on, I'll often have a bit of a crack these days. Still, I can't help myself at predicting, you know, how bad it looks. Not, you know, most people can see whether it's an ankle or a knee. I'm not trying to be that clever, but if I've got a view of what happens, I can tell whether it's a medial ligament or if it's a patella kneecap injury or whether it's an ACL mechanism. So that's the fine tuning of the part of that I used to do in the day.
Look, I certainly appreciate your point about guesswork, especially given, you know, your employment status in the first place. The whole thing was around the accuracy and the expert knowledge and that sort of thing. And as soon as, and it's interesting that I guess producers weren't necessarily always conscious or mindful of that. And like, you're brought in for that reason. And as soon as you start guessing and you start to make errors, then what am I here for? The impact diminishes.
Yeah. Your credibility goes, you know, I prided myself on being accurate. Secondly, my medical colleagues used to listen to me and they'd watch, and, you know, and even though they may not have been sports medicine colleagues, they knew my accuracy was there. And so if I was having a guess, you know, and getting it wrong, then bound to be one of them on Monday would you know, pull me up in the tea room at work and go, you know, how can you say Paul James had a hamstring? Everyone can see that was his quad, you know. So I never used to have it, you know. So I was conscious that, you know, I needed to be accurate. That's what I was getting paid for. And generally I was. And as I said, I was there to educate. So every time, you know, when I wasn't talking to my medical colleagues when I'm on the air, I was talking to the parents and the coaches and the kids. So when I tried to explain, you know, about a broken collarbone or about a hamstring and what treatment or how long they take, as much as you've got a very short amount of time when you're live anyway, to me it was all teaching. I was really teaching, because I realised that, you know, particularly as we've got more and more into the concussion and head injury stuff, it was a really big forum for me to be able to make it very, very clear that we had to be respectful of head injuries at the suburban and underage and school footy and those sort of things, because, you know, what you see, you know, happening on the TV, on the national, that's really mimicked.
It filters down.
And so I my chance to have an audience, if you like, Paul, you know, of a national audience, you know, sometimes we had a million people watching the finals on TV, you know. So I, you know, when I was, but you know, just to, even on a normal broadcast day, there'd be several hundred thousand people that you're speaking to. You never used to think about it, but I, you know, I was always speaking in layman's terms, dumbing it down, because I wanted people to understand when I'm explaining the injuries, because they might be a trainer from a footy club or a parent who's just coaching his under 15 girls soccer team, you know. So it was important that I was hopefully putting out health messages as well during that time when I was broadcasting.
And so obviously you just touched on head knocks and concussions and the like, and that's obviously becoming because
it's like an hour topic if we go. I didn't want to go into it too soon, but it's a big dilemma for sport worldwide at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, so how do we, I guess, and this could end up being an hour-long thing, so I'll you know, cut it off whenever you see fit in that regard. But I guess what still needs to be done, I guess?
Yeah, look, I mean, of all the time, look, we've talked about my experience, you know, and hamstrings and knees, and no one dies from those, right? But I've never been in an era of medical coverage of sport where I think we've got a challenge like we've got with the concussion. And I'll put mental health in that same sentence, Paul, because there is obviously a link between brain injury or brain misfunction, if you like, and dysfunction and what we're seeing, and whether there's a direct cause relationship between concussion and mental health. I'll come back to that. But at the moment, we're really at the bottom end of the steep learning curve. We've seen enormous changes in the way concussion is managed on the day in a competition. And I'll use AFL as an example, seeing we're talking at a footy show. So in the days when I was working at the Crows, and if we look back even in the 2000s, right up to 2012, if you got knocked out, you're expected to suck it up and go back on the ground. And, you know, and there was no suggestion that you'll be excluded from the rest of the game. It was not considered to be a significant injury by the medical world and by the neuroscientists. And it really was only in that 2010 period of time when I went to a conference at the Winter Olympics in Vancouver that they had a massive big session that I sat in on at the medical conference there at the Olympic Games, Paul, about how concussion was suddenly becoming a big issue in American football and in ice hockey. And how they were bringing in a rule to exclude the player on the day if they got concussed. And I thought, this will never get up in the AFL, because the AFL, you know, the tradition was that you had to be macho. And, you know, when you think of the Jordan Lewis, you think of Tommy Harley getting knocked out in that 08. You know, when we should have won 7, 8, and 9 as flags, just to come back to the Cats, right? But Tommy Harley completely got knocked into the next suburb. And he had no idea what he was doing. And yet he was back on the ground again, but he can't remember that part. So that was contemporary knowledge. And now we're in an era where we're having players who are suing. We've got litigation. We've got class actions. I won't talk about individual cases, but we've got an issue really where we're now finding that there are some long-term consequences associated with maybe just one single concussion. You don't have to get many concussions to have troubles, because there's been many players who have had really one bad one and never recovered properly. And then you've got other players who have had 10, 15, 12 and keep coming back to play. And I think, goodness, why are they? Because they become... their threshold to get concussed gets less and less each time, and they take longer to recover. And so I think this whole responsibility that sports have got and the coaches have got and even the parents of the players have got and the player themselves have got to have some insight, because we now have a big challenge of saying how many concussions are too many. We don't know. What are the long-term effects? You know, we're talking about depression and anxiety and anger and mental health issues, suicide, gambling, domestic violence. I mean, all these things have been linked to ex-sports people, particularly in the US, who are blaming their concussions on now their mental behaviour. And, of course, we've had suicides again associated. And now we've got this condition called CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, in other words, brain degeneration associated with trauma to the brain, which is being very strongly linked with sports trauma, not just other trauma. And so now we've got this incredible challenge of saying, how do we make the game safe? Because we're talking about how to treat concussion better, but I'm saying, well, it's too late. You've actually been concussed. We should be looking at how do we prevent concussion. And we're in a game which is full of collision and high velocity, a 360-degree game. So I think there's a bit of a challenge going on for sports, not just AFL. No, but, you know, horse racing with the jockeys, with soccer, with NFL, with ice hockey, because it's a collision. It's a violent game. Players go into it voluntarily knowing they might hurt a hamstring, knowing they might hurt a knee. So now do we have to sign a waiver that you might hurt your brain? So I don't know, because, you know, you can't completely eradicate head knocks. And I'll go back to the Cats, Gary Rowan and Jeremy Cameron,
yeah.
I mean, they're two teammates. Now, if Gary Rowan, I can't remember who we were playing that day, I was at the game, but let's say if it was a Melbourne player that had done that to Cameron, he would have got 6 weeks for that. Because it was an accident. So you can hit heads accidentally. A training, a teammate can do it. So we're not going to eradicate head knocks. What we have to understand is players are taking, they've been coming back too quickly, and we don't
get... You know, it was Melbourne, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for helping me out, because I did say, but you know, that was a teammate versus teammate. Yet I bet you that would have been all over the papers, and there would have been a fight and a scuffle afterwards. If Rowan had been in a Melbourne jumper, he would have been accused of being, you know... And here, you know, so the issue.
And you did see that sentiment get echoed on the internet, you know, at least on the internet, you know, as I'd skim through and see what people are saying about these things.
Yeah.
You would see that comment from time to time. You say, well, if this was an opposition player, there would be a consequence.
Yeah.
And a pretty severe one at that.
Yeah. I mean, you look, and again, I said I wouldn't mention cases, but you look at Angus Brayshaw with Maynard, you know, in that incident where Brayshaw got completely, you know, cleaned up in the first quarter in what was a genuine challenge in a contest. But of course, it was a challenge that was a dangerous challenge with what he did. And it's now going to be ruled out that you can't do that. And Maynard didn't go out there to knock Brayshaw out.
There's no malice to it, of course.
But my example that I'm using there is that players that have had multiple concussions, you know, and whether it's Paddy McCartan or whether it's Angus or whether it's Liam Picken at the Bulldogs, you know, these players, some of them had to retire. You know, so we've got a real concern about a crop of players who have had lots of concussions who are wanting to come back and still continue their career. And we're saying, well, is it safe to do so? And no one's got that answer. So what I'm really fluffing around here is we don't have all the answers as to why some people recover better from concussions than others. And so the dilemma that sports have got, all those sports I mentioned, not just AFL, is how do they make the rules, which they are doing. The AFL listens to every rule suggestion, you know, the sliding rule, the head over the ball, the sling tackle, the spear tackle. Every time they get pointed out a dangerous part of the game, they introduce that. So people say, oh, the AFL's not doing enough about concussion. Well, what do you want them to do? I mean, you know, and there's now discussion about not allowing, you know, full tackling in training and the number of things you're allowed to do, like they do in certain sports overseas. So we're changing the fabric of the game to make it safer for the players, but we're a long way away from getting all the answers right, Paul.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's still so much research that needs to be done in the space to ensure that the players are supported, that people are educated. There's a lot of road still ahead of us.
Yeah, and again, just to... there are far more concussions occurring in country football and suburban football and school football than are at the AFL. So while we're talking about highlight cases and, the ones that make the papers, there's a lot more brains out there getting rattled around every weekend in sport that we have to be careful of, because CTE doesn't just happen in AFL players or NFL footballers. CTE can be a tradie who's playing up at Bairnsdale in a month's time in a footy match and gets concussed and he gets it. So we've got to look and see, because there's a threat, I suppose, to the sports in one sense, because parents are looking at the safety of certain sports already and saying, do I want Jenny to play this sport or do I want, Jimmy to play this sport?
Because AFL versus soccer or whatever it might happen to be.
Yeah. So all the sports have got a public relations challenge, I think, going on there. But the head injury, mental health one, to me, it's at the top of the tree. Yes, we'd like to stop ACL injuries, and yes, we'd like to stop hamstring injuries, and we're doing training and conditioning for those. But how do we condition the brain so that when it gets smacked as hard as it does when it hits the surface at Marvel Stadium or gets kneed in the head, how do we stop the brain from rattling? We haven't got that. There's not any mechanism of preventing that at this stage, even with the duty of care that comes from the opposition player having to be careful.
Yeah, there's a lot of road still ahead, and hopefully at the end of the day we come to an outcome that is with the players' safety at the forefront.
Absolutely. I mean, just the whole reputation of the game depends upon that. And as I said, we've got all these litigation cases, which I mean, that's a Pandora's box, because we're talking about AFL players and we've already had an NFL case that got settled. We got soccer players in Europe that are coming up with suing because of the way they were treated. And I'm not saying they haven't got genuine problems, Paul, but what I'm saying is where does that end? Because what's to stop the suburban footballers who were put back on the ground because there wasn't good medical care there, and now what stopped them suing the East Gippsland League?
Yeah.
So it's a real dilemma for the lawyers. It's not just a medical problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing, and I guess we are recording this in a bit of a vacuum, as we touched on early on, but something that's kind of popped up in the news this week has been player weights and those sorts of things, and kind of the way that is or isn't documented. Now, I know it's not, I guess, quite the same realm, but I guess what's your current stance on what's transpired in that space?
Oh, my current stance has been the stance I've had all the way along, is that there are certain responsibilities as a player, regardless of what sport you're playing, to meet certain requirements for fitness, power to weight ratios. They used to have skin folds in my day at school, and when I was working with Crows and the Cats, it was skin folds. And people say, oh, you're shaming people and it's an invasion of privacy. Well, no, it's not. It's about having the players be educated, whether it's a female or a male player, as to what their best physiology way to present themselves is. And part of that is knowing whether you're carrying weight, because power to weight is an important thing in a lot of sport. And most of the top athletes are not overweight, no matter what sport you look at. You look at the Olympics in July this year coming up in Paris, you're not going to see many fat athletes at the Olympics, I can tell you now. So so the lean body mass, as it's called, which, you know, so it's important. It's not about shaming. I think it's just more important about allowing people to understand what their ideal weight is. So again, we've got to be careful we don't go to an extreme of saying everyone's got to be, you know, skin and bones, because that's not lean body mass. That's unhealthy weight loss.
But it's unhealthy.
I don't have a problem with targets being set, whether it's a skin fold measurement, whether it's an ultrasound measurement of body fat, or whether it's a weight situation. But it's got to be done scientifically, with the context of a sports scientist and a dietitian person giving you the correct advice as to what it should be. It's not just a rote formula that has to come through.
So I guess to that point, and I guess this maybe builds upon your answer there, the big, I guess, part of the topic this week has been the fact that this information has been public for the longest time, whether it's through the AFL Bibles and those sort of things, whether you can draw the information up online, whatever your resource might happen to be, and the fact that that's no longer going to be the case.
Yeah.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because we're seeing kind of mixed opinions.
Yeah, on that sense, I mean, I think it doesn't need to be public. You're right. I mean, what I was making the point was that it should be part of the athlete's preparation goals and getting that information internally, at least, from the sports science and the nutrition people particularly. And the doctors tend to get a bit involved in that, but I'm more talking about the fitness and conditioning people and the nutrition people. So I don't think it needs to be on a public website that, to know that, you know, Peter Larkins has got a body fat of 18% when he's supposed to have 15%. I mean,
yep.
But I think Peter Larkins as an athlete should be told what his targets should be, and he shouldn't go off to Vegas at the end of the season and come back 10 kilos heavier like the players used to do when I was working in the job. They'd go to Vegas.
Big off season.
Go to Bali and wherever they'd go. And now the players, you know, they don't come back, you know, twice the size that they were, because it takes too long to get back into shape. So they're more professional. So I think having numbers and targets and weights and those sort of things is reasonable. But yeah, as you say, having it public accessible, probably not, because I mean, why does it need to be? It's really designed to give the athlete the best preparation they can for their high performance goals.
I must say there's been no point in my consumption of football, and even, you know, talking about it a little bit in the last couple of years, where I've thought, oh, the fact that such and such is 92 kilos is really at all relevant to a particular conversation. You can kind of look at someone and go, okay, that's a bit, you know, Tom Hawkins is a giant hulking figure in the forward line. We know that he can ragdoll his opponent. We don't need to know that he's got a, I don't know, and I'm just throwing numbers out here. Sorry, Tom, if you're watching. We don't need to know if he's, you know, 5 kilos heavier or X number of kilos lighter or whatever happens to be. It's irrelevant. You can eyeball these things often and be able to render a, not fully educated, but a somewhat educated judgment.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I've got a lot of, most of my friends who are footy fans aren't medical, and everyone's got an eye when someone looks like they're carrying a couple of extra tubs of Haagen-Dazs on them, you know, after the end. Summer season, right? So I don't think, you know, you need to have the weight printed in the footy record. You can say, oh, he's carrying a bit more. Well, so I think, you know, as a sport fan, you have an eye for it, particularly if you know the player from serial over a few seasons. And I'm not talking about the guys who put on some muscle, because again, we see guys bulk up, so-called, and they're not having the jumper stretched over their guts, you know, like when we're saying these guys look a little bit, their shorts have gone up two sizes, you know. I'm talking about the guys that have bulked up.
They're broadened rather than rounded off.
So that's the acceptable weight gain. And a guy will go from 88 kilos at the end of 23 and he'll come back at 94 kilos. And it's not because he's got on the 6 kilos of fat. He's put on muscle in the gym and he's done his work. But the guys that are carrying weight wrongly, I think you generally have an eye for it. You can see in the way they're running. And again, I'm not mentioning names, but we've all seen them over the last decade, and you can see, so he doesn't look like he's in the shape he was last year.
Well, it was only the other day where I saw Dane Swan putting out a tweet where it was the back page of the Herald Sun commenting, I think it was in 2010. Was that the year he won the Brownlow? I think so. That was talking about his weight, and he then made sure to mention, hey, and I also won the Brownlow that year too. It is one of those things where there's players that will buck trends, there's things that might be obvious.
And players know. I mean, as an athlete, certainly as a runner, I had an ideal weight range that was within possible 1 to 2 kilo. That was the actual range that I had to work through. And certainly that you know yourself. And so I think if you really are motivated to perform well, you shouldn't have somebody pulling a whip out to tell you that you've got to shed two or three kilos.
So I guess because we're kind of close to winding things down, just cycling things back to, I guess, a bit of a Geelong focus. And obviously, as we've touched on, a giant Geelong fan from a very early age. So reflecting on 2007, and I know you're kind of in the media landscape at this point, but 7, 9 and 11, and even in more recent years, thinking about the 2022 Premiership, how did you reflect upon all of those? Because it obviously been such a drought leading up to that, that first one, and then this period of sustained success since.
Yeah.
What's it been like to enjoy?
You never get sick of success, I'll say that. And
it's been nice.
And 7, 9 and 11, of course, I was working on the boundary line broadcasting for Triple M. So what a joy, you know, to be there watching your team. I mean, 07, of course, you know, when we absolutely annihilated Port Adelaide, that was, and after 44 years and, you know, having been around the club, as I said, my dad, who had passed on before then, my family, having known the old players, you know, having seen so many of them over time, because I'm a member of the past players and officials yes. group down along with that. They're very good the way they look after us if you've been connected to the club in that way. So I'd seen all the old Mark Yates and the guys that had played in the 80s and the prelims that we lost and the grand finals that we lost. So 07 was just glorious in one sense. And I remember being at the ground the next day and, of course, the famous across at the hotel afterwards where you went across, you know, where the players used to go and having that whole day's recovery and, you know, people crying and Billy Brownless crying, you know, in the
yeah, it was still the telecast, yeah.
Yeah, and I was in the race waiting to come off. 09 was, of course, again, a challenging one, and 11 because of the closeness of the games as well. But, you know, frustrated in 08 because I thought we should have won 08 and, you know, we did, Stewie Jew, I still don't speak to Stewie Jew when I see him because he should have come off the ground with that sore knee he had. They sent him up forward and he kicks three goals in the space of a quarter and wins the game for, you know.
Multitude of things that he did wrong that day.
So, you know, the highs and lows of being there and, you know, and I've got photos of myself interviewing Gary Ablett in 07 because I had my Triple M top, but I had my Geelong jumper underneath it. So once the game was over, the Triple M came off and I had the Geelong jumper on underneath. And so here am I, I've got photos of me interviewing. So I really was, you know, I was the absolute fan nut, you know, when it came to it in that time. 2022, completely different, of course. Again, a victory that was predictable. You know, I didn't really start shouting about it until the third quarter, but a lot of my friends would at quarter time thought we'd won that. So, you know, put it away. So that was, again, a payback, I suppose, a payback for the players, I mean, in the sense of 21 and 20, we should have really had a win. And I think...
And you could make the argument for that 16, 17, 18 period, and 19 as well. I mean, there was prelim after prelim.
Yeah.
Kept bumping into Richmond at the peak of their powers. Yeah.
The great motivation, and I was very privileged to go to an event at the end of the 22-1 where there was a bit of a season analysis spoken about by some of the inner sanctum people and to know how they'd motivated, used 22, you know, as a motivation. Joel Selwood spoke at it, but I won't say who else spoke at it, but it was a very nice event to be at. But they spoke about, you know, using 20 and 21 as a motivation into 22. And so it was almost like no one was going to beat us in 22. And that's why it was disappointing, I suppose, in 23 for it to happen. But, you know, to be there in 7 and 9 and 11 and, you know, as a kid growing up and having to wait the 44 years from the 63 one, it was, it was pretty nice to be in the rooms and shouting around and down at the ground afterwards. And as I said, back at the Lord of the Isles pub, you know, which was famous for the Cats.
Pretty satisfying once the dam wall breaks, and then as we touched on before, it's been a nice 20-year block really of seeing a long team that's won far more than it's lost.
More so than a lot of other of my mates who belong to support other teams, and let's hope 24 with the group we've got, you know, and with people staying healthy, and you know, is that everyone's having a great preseason. Like all 18 clubs say, they're having the best preseason ever, which is but you know, we've still got a great squad, and we have a way of, you know, I think the motivation of last year and having, you know, Paddy Dangerfield still hanging in there and Tom, and you know, we've still got some, and the players that are coming through, you know, the player, the Holmes and Bruins of the world that have got extra time in their legs from 23 and 22, I think we'll see the fruits of that if they stay healthy. So I'll bring the medical hat on again.
There is the touch wood component. Yeah, we've got to keep everyone healthy.
Tom's been very good at load management and looking after players. So we didn't have a great 23. We had a few bad injuries and we missed people, but hopefully that won't be the case. Cam Guthrie coming back is a great bonus.
Oh, it's going to be huge. It's going to be great to see Cam there. And I'm hoping the dreadlocks are back because I feel like he lost a little bit of his magical power when they disappeared.
A bit of a Samson, wasn't it? Shaving the head didn't work, Cam. So
didn't work for him at all. So yeah. Get the locks back, Cam. I've seen some photos lately. He hasn't got the locks back, unfortunately. So
no, I did see them myself. Yeah.
Hopefully.
No, Zach's taken over with the hairstyle now.
Yeah, and wears it pretty well, I might add. As we start to wind things down, you've obviously had this amazing access over many years and have been able to see generations of Geelong players come through. In your eyes, who's the greatest cat of all time?
Oh, I didn't want
and
you
I do
to
say
ask.
Greatest, so I'm not necessarily talking best in terms of on-field and on-field only. It can be the whole really whatever way you want to spin it.
Let me tell you who my favourite player was when I was a kid, first of all. Johnny Sharrock was my favourite player. Now, I wasn't a left-footer, but I tried to kick left foot when I could. So Johnny Sharrock, who's still around and still comes to pass players and does stuff. So I think Johnny Sharrock was one of the most graceful, you know, beautiful, coming off half forward, left foot, just sweeping. I love watching him play. I love Mickey Turner. I just thought the dash and you know, especially when he was, you know, he used to play against Ricky Barham and they had the, you know, the great contest that the Barham versus Turner.
Yes.
But, you know, I had the privilege, Paul, both of working with Gary Ablett, watching Gary Ablett play, both of them. And, you know, it's hard not to say the best player was Ablett, but I don't want to say which one now because they're both so good. But, you know, and because, you know, I saw Carey play and I saw Lee Matthews play and, you know, and as they talk about Carey, they talk about Lee Matthews and they talk about Barassi and back to Ted Whitten, you know, if you want to say. But,
yeah.
But in terms of this influence and sheer brilliance, mark, kick, I mean, Gary Ablett Sr. probably, look, most players would acknowledge that. So in terms of the best Geelong player, then I couldn't put him. I'd put him ahead of Gary Jr. And I hope Gary Jr. is not going to ring me up and say, you know, but because, you know, what a heritage as a family for the, and along with Nathan, of course, as well. But I think Gary Sr. was, you know, watching him play and watching him not train, because he was the most gifted person who didn't train and still came out and influenced the game. So it was amazing that he would perform the way he did.
Well, if you don't have an Ablett on the phone yet, then you might have an Ablett on the phone after this next question, because it's
sorry,
a school
Gary,
year.
Sorry, I'm busy, Gary.
Breaking up, sorry. Schoolyard pick. You're building a team and you've got Gary Jr. and Senior in front of you. You've got to choose which way you're going to go for a team that you are building.
Oh, I'm going
to
go
Senior.
That's
a different sort of question at the end of the day because of the roles and responsibilities.
I'm going Senior for his height and his versatility, because I think I could throw Gary Senior around a few more positions that I could throw Gary Jr. Yep. around.
Makes a lot of sense.
I have Gary in the middle, you know, Gary Jr. in the middle and across, you know, the forward 40 and forward 30 any time. But I reckon I could put Gary Sr. up back and he'd do a Luke Hodge half back and work.
Of the current group of players, and I don't know if a certain other steeplechaser within the club gets a little bit of personal bias from you. I'm not too sure. We'll see you there. But of the current, I guess, list of players, who's and again, hopefully no phone calls are coming your way after this. Who's the favourite? Who do you just have that little bit of extra love for at the Cats?
Oh, gee, I've loved for a lot of them, boys. So I mean, Tommy Stewart gets my vote at the moment because I like Tommy's brutal application, his leadership, his, you know, he backs himself, takes him on. You know, he's got a bit of brute about him. You know,
never
he's not
shirks
the,
contest.
Not the nice Tommy. He's got a bit of brute about him, but I think his leadership and his ability. I mean, you mentioned Mark Lixarves, of course, he's a great 1,500-metre runner. So if you speak to Mark, he was actually a great 1,500-metre runner who ran a few steeplechases. But his dad was in the same Olympic team as me, by the way.
Yeah, right.
So Blix, I've really got an affection for because of his – and he is Mr. Utility. When we talk about, you know, utility players, which is not a term that gets used very often in AFL in the last 5 or 6 years, he's the true utility player. Who forward, back, ruck, you know, you name it. So Mark's been an outstanding crossover and used his athleticism, you know, to his ability through that. So I think Tommy Stewart along with Mark, you know, in that sense. I mean, Joel, to me, I know he's not the current list, so I understood your question, but Joel was just the complete leader. I mean, yeah, I mean, my son's favourite player was Joel, and just because you talk about leading by example and make, you know, when Joel was just the guy that get that one clearance when we just needed it at the 10-minute mark of the last quarter when we were 6 points down, and he'd go in the middle and he'd get the clearance. And so from a reliability point of view and setting the example, and of course it didn't matter how bloody he got, he just put his head in there. And so, you know, his own safety didn't come into it. Now, I'm not advocating that you should not.
Yeah, that's it. a weird that spot for
yeah,
you there.
But... So if I put Tommy Stewart up there now, but you know, look, I'm hoping Max Holmes develops into one of the great stars. I mean, I heard about him before I even saw him. I heard about his reputation from a very, very well-connected Geelong person, and I thought it sounds too good to be true. And I really think Holmes has got the ability to also have a great career ahead of him at Geelong.
Well, that might answer my next one as well, which is, I guess, the next crop that are coming through, who is it you got the closest eye on? But I suspect it's Max Holmes.
It is Max Holmes, yeah. And, you know, I want to give a mention to Zach Guthrie, because I think he got really – he really copped a lot of bad publicity when he first came. He was very – talk about putting on weight for the right reasons, you know, building up, getting stronger, getting taller. I really admire the way Zach persisted, because Cam got all the accolades and obviously was the star that he was. But Zach came in and out of the team, and he was undersized and took on some big names that he had to play against at halfback when he first came in. And so I really admire the way that Zach stuck to it and, you know, stayed on track and backed himself. And I'm really pleased to see him do as well as he did over the last couple of seasons.
And the club backed him as well, because when you get that, you know, external noise and things aren't quite working internally as well, yeah, you know, clubs can be prone to maybe pulling the lever a little bit, which is, you know, thankfully something they didn't do with Zach.
But especially with the social media being as active as it is, too, which the players can really get down if they're reading about that, because that's the era that the players are in now when they're getting criticised. They have to put up with that sort of stuff.
Absolutely. There's lots of great things to social media, but that's a really awful side of it.
The people that, you know, because often you don't know what a player's going through off the field. You don't know some of the stresses that might be the mental health stresses. They might be carrying an injury that you don't know about, and that's the reason they're not performing as well, but they get absolutely smashed and brutalised, and it's good to see them rise back up and hold their spot and be, you know, an immediate selection when they get to that selecting of the team. You see Zach's name goes in there, bang, as long as he's fit and available, and that's what I've really enjoyed about seeing him back in there.
Yeah, he's a walk-up start, and we love having him. It's been fantastic to see. I guess looking the other side of the game, and something that's developing quite a lot in recent years, the AFLW, the women's game, how are you seeing things traveling in that space as well? And I guess specifically, even when it comes to the Cats, what are you seeing there in terms of how things are going?
Yeah, I think as a concept, obviously fantastic. And we've seen the teams come in, and we missed out. I remember talking to Brian Cook, and we were trying to get our Cats team in the early days, and we missed out. And they've come through. But look, it probably got ahead of itself in the early days in terms of the number of people that were available to support the AFLW system. It probably launched a bit quicker than it should. I think, what are we up to, 7 years now? There just wasn't the infrastructure around the medical, the physios, the performance, the assistants. And so these girls were coming in and being thrown into a brutal game in a very short season at the wrong time of the year on hard grounds without any pre-season, coming from sports. And so we didn't have the quality because they haven't grown up with a footy in their hands. So what we're seeing is this generational thing over the next 5 to 10 years where the girls at 3 and 4 will grow up with a footy in their hand the same way the boys have done. But they'll also grow up understanding that it's a 360 game, because what we've done, we've had so many brutal knee injuries and injuries coming through from some stars that have crossed over, Paul, from netball, from hockey, elite athletes. But they're not used to getting tackled. They're not used to the 360 direction of the game, and certainly the concept of that body awareness. And so we've seen a huge spike, as you know, in ACL injuries in the knee in the women, much more so than men, and much more so than in other sports that women and men play together, like hockey, basketball, soccer. So the AFLW's had another level again. And it's because they haven't had the pre-seasons. They were playing on hard grounds at the start of the year. There are certain physiological things will never change with women, right? The strength is never going to be there. That there's a different shape to the girl's knees and pelvis, just to go back into the medical description for a bit. So there's always going to be a higher incidence of women's knee injuries in sport where men and women play the same sport. But AFLW, so back to the statistics, 5 to 6 times the rate of knee injuries in women in soccer, women in basketball, women in hockey, women in other sports like volleyball compared to men.
Comparable ones, yeah.
Suddenly AFLW comes along and it's 8 to 10 times higher we're going, what the heck's going on? And so we've looked at, there's six or seven things, as I said, strength, the shape of the knee, the tackling, the grounds. But they don't have the pre-season. They were rushed in and rushed out, and they don't get the recovery. They don't have all that infrastructure behind them. So the more professionalism that comes into AFLW over time, I think we're getting there. But it's still a slow burn, and you know, we've got some absolute stars at Geelong. You know, we need the depth, because we talk about the top 22. You need your best. You need your 22nd.
Run through to 30, yeah.
Your 22nd and then 26th player. So with the women, there's been some absolute stars, the top five or six, and then other girls that have come through there that haven't had the ability to put in the conditioning or put in the, because they're all teachers or they're all working in the bank, or they, you know, so they're not full time. And so the standard is gradually growing, particularly, as I said, as the 3 and 4 and 5 year old girls now grow up playing the Oz kids and understand the nuances of footy.
Yeah, it's going to be huge, and I think there's a very, very bright future ahead for the competition, and hopefully the Cats are part of that, and pinching a few premierships along the way. It'd be a fantastic thing to see, and certainly the current squad looks pretty good.
Well, they look good, they look good.
Yeah. Unlucky, I will say, in the end. I won't delve too much deeper in that, but unlucky. Peter, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show and to learn about your journey through this entire industry, but to discuss the athletics and some of those amazing experiences you've been a part of. Thank you so much for sharing all of that. If people, and we touched on social media and where people might see a tweet from time to time about the game, if people do want to see what you're up to or hear some of your thoughts, where should people go?
Yeah, well, look, at Doc Larkins is my X handle, as it's called, or Twitter handle.
Oh, yeah, X.
When I do venture into talking about a tennis injury at the moment, with the tennis just finishing up, and with the footy coming along and the cricket, I do that on that. But also I have an Instagram, which is just Dr. Peter Larkins. And so that's the public or professional one that's accessible to everybody. And then drpeterlarkins.com is a website, which really is more my health website, talking to people about how to live healthy and the concept of healthy, you know, getting your best out of yourself in high performance in life. So so there's a few things there between the at Doc Larkins and the Instagrams.
So please, people, make sure to check all of those resources out. As we said before, you've got the propensity to pop the occasional tweet out when you make an observation of an injury. That's really fascinating reading as well. There's so much there that people can learn from you. So please, I implore everyone who's watching and listening today to utilize this wonderful resource that has given an amazing amount of time to me today on the show too, by the way. So thank you very much for sticking around.
Nice. Thanks, James Paul. And let's have a good year for the Cats in 24. Go, boys.
He's hoping. Cats fans, if you haven't already done so, please make sure to subscribe to the Hoops Crew on YouTube. Follow Behind the Play on podcast feeds to catch up with. We've got some of the AFLW girls coming on board. We've got AFL men's players coming on board. We've got a range of amazing people from throughout the AFL industry, and specifically the Geelong scene, coming on board. So please make sure to check all of that out over the course of 2024. Again, Peter, thank you very much for coming on the show. Cats fans, remain Geelong strong, and I'll see you next time.
Cheers.